Let me tell you about a product that I am using personally, and I really think this works. You know, beetroot juice has been used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, and studies show that it can increase athletic performance and stamina by 16%. So call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com and you can get a 30-day supply free of this great product. It comes with your first order and it's backed by a money-back guarantee. 800-738-2198. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. The subject is Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. And our guest is Dr. Leo Galland. Dr. Galland practices integrative medicine here in Manhattan. And he's the author of several books. And you've got a website, right, Leo?
PillAdvise.com.
And before we get into or continue our discussion of Lyme disease, tell us a little bit about your PillAdvise website. It's quite an interesting project.
Well, it started out as a way to make information about interactions between supplements, medications, and food available. And I created a really extensive database on that topic. But it's flowered into a site that has guest columns from some of the leading integrative practitioners in the world. I think you're on there, Ron. And also news items that are of interest to health-conscious consumers and professionals.
So PillAdvise.com is
right.
A great accompaniment to Intelligent Medicine.
Right, and my son Jonathan runs that website and is really has done a great job of maintaining the quality.
Yeah, indeed. I post frequently on Facebook and Twitter from some of the excellent articles there. So we were in discussing in part one, you know, we kind of laid out the themes, which is that Lyme disease and co-infections are sometimes difficult to diagnose, and sometimes it's difficult to tell whether a patient is sick from a persistent infection or from the aftermath of an infection or from both. It isn't easy to discern, but we got into in discussing babesiosis, there is the prospect that natural treatment can sometimes be effective. Now, I think you'd be the first one to say that, you can't just cure all these things with an herbal or nutraceutical armamentarium, but what place do natural therapies have in treating Lyme disease?
Well, the effectiveness of conventional antibiotic therapy is limited enough by several different kinds of factors that there's a major role for complementary treatments and occasionally alternative strategies, but mostly complementary strategies. And I think that they work on they can work on several levels. The first is to helping to prevent the emergence of persister organisms or the ability of persisters to maintain their viability. And there are several things that I have people do while they're on antibiotic therapy to prevent that from happening. Then there is the ability of natural therapies to help to compensate for the tendency of antibiotics to produce dysbiosis or mitochondrial damage. Finally, there is the possibility that there are natural products that can actually substitute for antibiotics. And this becomes especially important when there are chronic infections and when there are multiple infections and you can't deal with all of them at the same time. We can go through those decisions kind of one by one. I think that's the best way to do it because it's such a complicated area. You know, Borrelia, the bacteria that cause Lyme disease, they are such complex bacterial bacteria, and they produce incredibly complicated infections. Researchers have actually described Lyme disease as being Machiavellian in their ability to elude the immune system of host animals. You know, that's a very, scientists, you know, tend to be very
sort of dispassionate,
parsimonious, and dispassionate. So for a scientist to start calling a bacterial infection Machiavellian, it's got to be pretty substantial.
So some of the treatments that have been proposed, let me go through them kind of like lightning round here. Colloidal silver. There are a lot of people who are drinking colloidal silver in an effort to eradicate their Lyme disease. That's been popularized. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I've been pretty unimpressed with colloidal silver on its own as an effective treatment. However, colloidal silver may play a role as part of an anti-biofilm therapy. And there has been research looking at wounds using a combination of lactoferrin, xylitol, and silver to eradicate organisms living in biofilms and to break down biofilms. And the use of xylitol and lactoferrin for biofilms associated with Lyme disease is something that was brought to my attention by Joe Jemczyk, who's a very creative Lyme physician in Washington, D.C., and for whom I have a lot of respect. Since Joe told me about his use of lactoferrin and xylitol, I've been exploring it with some of my patients, and I've added colloidal silver because when you look at the research that was done in wound care, silver was another component. So I think that colloidal silver may have some potential as an adjunct in terms of the breakdown of biofilms.
So a brief digression on the subject of biofilms, because we talk about biofilms in relationship to the mouth, around the cause of plaque, dental plaque. We talk about biofilms in the sinuses when we talk about the use of xylitol nasal spray to break up the biofilms. But how does it relate to these chronic infections?
Okay, well, there are two mechanisms by which Lyme disease may produce a chronic infection. And in test tubes and in tissue culture, Borrelia can cause the formation of these biofilms. And I think the best way to visualize a biofilm is by going to what you've already talked about. If you just run your finger over the surface of your teeth and gums, there's this kind of sticky, it's not just saliva, there's this sticky, slimy kind of very thin layer that's present, especially on the gums. That's a biofilm, and it's a kind of mucilaginous layer that bacteria produce. They hide in. Antibiotics have a hard time penetrating into them. Your immune system has a hard time penetrating into it. What hasn't been proved is that Lyme organisms can actually form biofilms in an intact animal, inside, in your tissues, as opposed to on a surface. Because all of the research with biofilms has basically been done on surfaces, like inside the gums, the nose, the sinuses, where there are prostheses, like an artificial hip, for example. But biofilms are a major problem preventing the eradication of chronic infections on surfaces.
So it's as if they encase themselves in biofilms. That's the Machiavellian part, is that they, it's harder to penetrate the biofilms to get at the organisms.
Right. And so it is possible. There are a number of treatment anti-biofilm protocols that have been proposed, basically proteolytic enzymes, like serapeptase, and Wobenzym actually is the one that I tend to use the most because it's been around the longest. It's been around for 60 years or so.
Actually, there's even research saying that it helps antibiotics penetrate the prostate in prostatitis. So there's
There's maybe more research with Wobenzym than with other proteolytic enzymes. That's one approach. And then there's the xylitol lactoferrin approach to biofilms. There are antibiotics that have superior ability to penetrate biofilms, and even though they're not the standard antibiotics used for treating Lyme disease, they may be useful as adjunctive antibiotics. And it's possible that some of the herbs, garlic in particular, is very good at breaking up biofilms. But the other mechanism by which Lyme disease can resist treatment is by the formation of organisms that are called persisters. Now, if you take any population of bacteria, and this is research that's been done at Northeastern and at MIT, if you take any population of bacteria, some percentage of those bacteria exist as persister forms. Persisters are very slow growing, and they're quite resistant to oxidative stress. And most antibiotics kill bacteria by inducing a state of oxidative stress. Well, that won't generally kill persisters, and they also work best against rapidly growing organisms, which is why they don't kill persisters.
It's a little bit like the Virginia Livingston theory about L forms, you know, persisting in the tissue causing disease.
Right, right. Well, actually, the initial description of Lyme persisters were as L forms and then as cysts. These scientists in Norway identified cyst forms of Lyme, as they called it, or ring forms. And those are probably persisters. There are some antibiotics that may be able to kill persisters. Pulsing antibiotic therapy is an approach that may effectively kill persisters. Oxygen is effective.
We've got, the next question I was going to ask is in our lightning round, ozone, peroxide, hyperbaric oxygen. What about that?
You know, I think that those oxidative therapies should be used in conjunction with antibiotics, not separately from antibiotics, because the Boston researchers have shown that if you can maintain a slightly higher level of oxygen, you can prevent the persisters from persisting.
And actually brings up the possibility that intravenous vitamin C at high doses might be helpful, because it turns out that it's not a antioxidant at the high doses, it's a prooxidant that generates peroxide in the tissue. So maybe that could be an adjunct as well.
Yes, oxidative therapies can be useful. I mean, they're not proven, but they make sense as adjunctive therapies for preventing the development, the entrenchment of persisters. And I think they should be done in conjunction with antibiotics, not separately from antibiotics, because they can make up for a weakness of the antibiotics, which is that almost all antibiotics allow persisters to flourish.
Some people have suggested hyperthermia as a way of treating Lyme disease, saunaing like a dry sauna kind of approach using infrared.
Absolutely. Heat dramatically increases the effectiveness of antibiotics against Borrelia organisms. I mean, dramatically. Like, for penicillin, it's a 10,000-fold increase in killing. So that saunas are very helpful. And again, I think that heat therapy should be used as an adjunct, not a substitute.
Mm-hmm.
That's one area. Then the other area is the damage produced by the antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And there you kind of have a fine line to walk, because the question is, what can you do to protect mitochondria that will not interfere with the antibiotic activity? Well, the researchers, again, the Boston researchers, have looked at this issue, not with regard to Borrelia, but when they've looked at other kinds of mitochondrial damage and other organisms, let's say staph, for example. And it seems as if NAC, N-acetylcysteine, which is a generally safe and inexpensive and natural antioxidant, is able to do that. Coenzyme Q10 probably also makes sense, unless you're treating babesiosis with drugs.
Yeah, I've heard that it should not be used with one particular antibiotic, Mepron, that seems to be neutralized by it, which is an unusual antibiotic.
Well, etoveqone, which is available as Mepron, and also is one of the components in Malarone, which are the anti-malarials used for babesia, actually work by blocking coenzyme Q10 synthesis.
Wow.
However, what's unclear is whether the organisms of babesia may need to produce its own coenzyme Q10. They may not be able to take up your coenzyme Q10.
Okay.
In order to protect themselves.
So a little bit like giving folic acid to people on methotrexate, use it as kind of a rescue remedy.
Yeah. So it's unclear whether, but in general, my approach is I don't put people on CoQ10 when they're getting etoveqone, just because I would need stronger proof that it's not going to be a problem.
So those are some of the means of mitochondrial support. Of course, there are other things, probably, you know, carnitine and ribose and perhaps creatine for some people.
Those just haven't been studied, but there are test systems. So the NAC is the only thing that's really been studied in the appropriate test system, but there are a lot of things that would be rational to use.
Well, what about testing? Because this is really controversial. There's actually guidelines that you're only supposed to use certain tests, and other tests are considered kind of iffy in terms of their predictive value. So what's your take on that?
Well, okay, the problem with laboratory testing is it's imperfect, no matter whose criteria you use or what standards you use. The most imperfect are the CDC criteria. They're overly restrictive, and there are so many people who have active chronic Lyme disease in particular who do not meet CDC criteria or even come close to it, so basically the CDC criteria, if they're negative, are worthless. If they're positive, they're meaningful if someone hasn't previously been treated.
So exactly. In other words, how do you know if a person has chronic Lyme disease, if they've previously had Lyme disease and the antibodies may be lurking, which gives you the picture that Lyme was there? You know, it's like graffiti. You know, Kilroy was here, but is Kilroy still here?
Yeah, it's very challenging to make that decision. What I do in my practice is, the first question is, does this person have symptoms? I mean, is the person sick? And does the person have symptoms, even subtle ones, that are consistent with Lyme disease? Now, I have some patients with chronic Lyme disease who are responsive to antibiotic therapy, for example, who are pretty functional and pretty well, but have some joint pain. Some, it could be relatively minor, or some degree of fatigue, or their mental sharpness and memory is just not what it used to be.
It's a little harder to tell when a person comes in and they're, the 57 or 62 or, 68, and it's like, what's going on here?
Well, look, let me just say that from my own personal experience, age does not necessarily impact on memory or cognitive function except to improve it.
All right.
Okay. I mean, as you get older, if you're really healthy and your brain is healthy, you're able to see patterns more clearly. That's the normal part of the aging brain. It may be normal to forget names or to have problems retrieving words. It's kind of like forest and trees.
Right. You wouldn't want to go to med school all over again and start, spewing out anatomical facts.
No, but what, I mean, it's really like the forest and the trees. As you get older, you're much better at seeing the forest than when you were younger, but the trees don't mean as much to you.
Yeah, no, pattern recognition certainly is one of the great features of aging, experience, and judgment.
Right, right. So I never accept aging as an explanation for infirmity.
Right. You know, so
Hasn't been my personal experience. I don't think, I mean, there's always illness that underlies infirmity.
And that's what I tell many of my patients is that, they say, well, maybe it's just me getting old. And I go, well, I don't think we have to accept that necessarily. Let's probe for an answer. What about the risk of over-treatment? Unfortunately, there are a lot of, I will say this frankly, there are some doctors who are Lyme enthusiasts. They see Lyme virtually behind every conceivable symptom, and they treat very aggressively. And sometimes patients come in, and I'm not sure whether it's the underlying condition that they're suffering from or from the aggressiveness of the treatment, multiple rounds of antibiotics and, sometimes holistic treatments that are kind of depleting.
Well, that's a definite issue. If you're a physician who sees Lyme in every patient and who treats aggressively with antibiotics, what will happen is there will be a lot of people whom you really help, because there are a lot of people out there with Lyme disease and who need aggressive treatment. But then there will be other people who actually are worse off as a result of what you've done for them. And usually you won't know about those people. I mean, see, that's what happens in medicine in general. Doctors get, there's a lack of feedback that doctors get. The people that are satisfied and happy with your care, they're the ones that you know about.
It's a little bit of a selection bias in terms of
there's
success.
A selection bias, and it happens in conventional medicine
big time.
All the time, big time. But it happens in integrative and alternative medicine as well. You don't know about the people that you didn't help or that actually got worse. I mean, I would say that one of the biggest learning points for me early in my career was when I'd gone into a small town to set up a general medical practice, and I began calling people that I hadn't seen in a while to see what was happening with them. I learned so much from that about the course of illness and how different it is for different people and how differently people respond to treatments. I mean, just doing that taught me as much as I learned in medical school.
Well, what that suggests is that patients shouldn't just be making appointments with doctors. Doctors should be making appointments with patients so that they can learn more.
I really encourage people to give their doctors feedback. And not only the ones that have helped them, but the ones that haven't helped them.
Yeah, and if something comes along that has been helpful for them, and I've learned a lot in that fashion too. Sometimes people have said, "Hey, you did this and that, and I felt a little better." But let me tell you about this therapy or this supplement or something that I underwent, and that was a real breakthrough for me. And I learned tremendously from that feedback. So I appreciate that kind of feedback.
But you're an unusual physician in that way, Ron. Those of us that are open-minded and curious and really want to know about the things that we don't know that have helped our patients, unfortunately, there are not enough of us. I mean, I've had patients who are being treated by specialists for specific problems, and who weren't getting help by the specialists, but they have to keep going back to them because they, you know, like they needed
for monitoring.
Colonoscopies and monitoring and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I would put them on a treatment that really made all the difference. And they'd say, well, you know, I went to see my gastroenterologist and or my neurologist, and he said, wow, you're so much better. I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it. And don't tell me what it is.
Right. Or when the patient endeavors to explain to the doctor what they're doing, the doctor's eyes glaze over and they just kind of, you know, la, 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 la. You know, they don't want to hear about it. So this has really been a fascinating discussion, I think, of great utility for a lot of people out there who are suffering from tick-borne diseases or who might be candidates for an investigation of whether their bizarre, challenging, and elusive symptoms might be related to a chronic infection. It's a very, very important part of integrative medicine, and I think you're doing a marvelous job and continue to evolve in your approach towards a very, very challenging medical issue. Is there, you know, we issue a call to action on each edition of Intelligent Medicine. Is there a place where people can learn more about your approach to chronic disease?
Well, I definitely think that the best clearinghouse for information about Lyme disease in general, in addition to pill advice, because we do feature Lyme there, is ILADS, the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society.
ILADS. .org?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah, I mean, ILADS is constantly at the forefront of trying to put together the latest information about Lyme and its diagnosis and treatment.
Okay. Once again, pilladvised.com is your website. You're located in Manhattan. The name is spelled G-A-L-L-A-N-D. And thank you very much. And once again, I congratulate you for tackling, you seem to gravitate towards challenging issues in medicine. And I can think of no bigger challenge than solving the mystery of chronic infections. But you're doing an admirable job on behalf of your patients. And thanks for the great work you do.
Well, thank you, Ron. It was great speaking with you. And I will just want to reiterate that there is no greater challenge in medicine today, at least in the United States, than dealing with the problem of chronic Lyme disease and related tick-borne infections. And it deserves so much more attention from the scientific community than it's received. So
and not the mere couple of million dollars that are expended in our national healthcare budget.
Right.
Indeed. That's a real call to action also on the political front for people who are faced with this challenging medical condition. Thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Leo Galland. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.